So today we are in Genesis 25 and 26. They're kind of, I don't know what I'd say, just kind of reporting verses. They're kind of transitioning from Abraham and Isaac to what's going to happen with Jacob. And last Thursday when I started reading through this passage, I actually started thinking, well, this is all kind of very droll, but at least there's a lot. And as I read through it, and I'm playing it on my the YouVersion Bible app in my truck, and I'm working on it through the days, and finally today, kind of as I looked at it, it's actually more interesting than I thought. Even though there's some genealogies, genealogies have a lot of importance in the Bible. You're going to see these names, not all of them, but down the line in the Bible. So there is some cool things here. So if hopefully I can, some of the things I learned in the last couple days after struggling through it, share with you. But Genesis 25, starting in verse 1. Now Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah, and she bore him Zimran, Jokin, Medan, Midian, Isbak, Shua, Joshkin became the father of Seba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ashram and Letushim and Lehumanim, and the sons of Midian were Epith, Epher, Hanok, Abida, Elida, and all those were sons of Keturah. Now Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away to, from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. One of the reasons why I don't like the genealogies is as many times as I listen to it and try to pronounce it, I just butcher it every time. But so Abraham took another wife. At first I thought, well, what is he doing? Didn't he have enough? But at the same time, he's an old guy. We don't know where she came from, whether she was somebody that was in his household or one of his maids or whatever. But he took another wife, and in his old age, after all that, I can see why, you know, a fellow wouldn't want to be alone. And he's blessed with more children. Obviously, Isaac is the child of the promise, but God did promise him that he would have many descendants. So these six sons, and it lists his grandsons, came out of that. And so he's just blessed in his old age by having more family. I think they must have been healthier or had more energy when they were older, because even now, having my grandkids, after last Saturday, we had our grandkids all day, and I was wiped out after. So he must have had more energy. But in verse 6, 5 and 6, he gave all that he had to Isaac, but he sent, he gave gifts to his other son, the sons of his concubines, and sent them away. And here's where I started thinking about Abraham is thinking ahead. He's an old man. He's had a good life. But again, like Ishmael, he is still thinking into the future for the sake of his kids. So he didn't leave the kids of Keturah untaken care of. He sent them away with gifts. But at the same time, what he did here is he's thinking about maybe strife, maybe things that could happen. So what he does in sending them away is making sure that they're taken care of, but the son of the promise is preserved with all that he has. So it's just kind of cool that in his old age and looking at his sons, he's still taking care of his family. He doesn't say, well, I'm at the end of it, good luck, y'all. He leaves them with a plan. And so they went to the east, and then verse 7, these are the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died at a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. Then his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zoar the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field which Abraham had purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. And it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived in Beer Leroyhi. However you say that. So 175 years, that's old. It's interesting, in the King James Version it says that he gave up his spirit. And so it's one of those things where I think God chooses our time of death, but it's just cool that Abraham's a man that walked with God. And when he breathed his last, whether he gave up his spirit, whether that was part of his will or he and God are working it together, that he gives up his spirit. And I think it, when he gives it up, you get the flavor from the text that he was a peaceful man at that time. He'd lived, he'd experienced everything, and it seems like he's looking forward to going to heaven. So he breathed his last, and he was satisfied with life, and so he was gathered to his people, meaning that all the other people that had died before him who were believers, he's going to be with God, of course, and with them. And so he's buried in the same cave that he had acquired for Sarah, and then God blessed Isaac. And that's important because when God promised to Abraham that he would bless him, that included his descendants. So as you see, as we go through the rest of Genesis, you see that even through their trials, God continues to maintain his promise to his people from generation to generation. So verse 12, now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names in the order of their birth, Nebaioth, the firstborn of Israel, and Kedar, and Abiel, and Mispam, and Mishma, and Dumrah, and Massa, and Hadad, and Tamra, and Judar, and Napith, and Kedethma. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are the names by the villages and their camps, 12 princes among according to their tribes. These are the years of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. And they settled in Hevelah to Shur, to the east of Egypt, as one goes toward Syria, and he settled in defiance of his relatives. So the Bible text puts in here this generation or the this account of Ishmael's sons. And again, this is, you know, one of the things that God said is you will have many descendants. He has the 12 sons, and they're listed here. We don't really hear much about Ishmael anymore, but with the 12 tribes, that kind of parallels the 12 tribes of Israel, but these guys are not the 12 tribes of the promise again. But in verse 18, the interesting thing that they settled in defiance of their relatives east of Egypt. So there's the things that are still going on in the Middle East, this is kind of where they started, where Ishmael and Isaac are brothers. You saw them, they're together when they buried their dad, but at the same time, for whatever reason, that he did it in defiance of their relatives. And I'm not sure whether it's because of where they settled or because that Isaac is still sojourning in the land. He's still moving around, whether they were not supposed to settle there because they were supposed to be moving, or that was not a place they were supposed to settle. But at any rate, it was at the defiance of his relatives. So that continues to this day. Verse 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham came the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, and the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. Now the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So it's very short there, but it's kind of interesting. Just like his father, they've been married 20 years, and he went to the Lord and asked him for a son. Because you'd think at 60, if you want to have kids, now's the time to do it. But it doesn't say if he went to there before, but he went to the Lord on behalf of his wife. He interceded for his wife that she may bear a son. And this is not the first time we've seen intercessory prayer. We've talked about Abraham interceded for Lot. and Lot was taken out of the city. And so one of the things that I've noticed this time going through Genesis that I didn't notice before is how much intercessory prayer these guys had for their families. And it seems important to me as parents and as people in the church that we be praying for each other, that we be interceding for the needs and the hurts of people or the things that people are desiring. And not things that we desire, like, you know, Lord, I want a Cadillac. And it wouldn't be bad to have a Cadillac, I suppose. But the things that, you know, delight yourself in the Lord, and you will have the desires of your heart. So if you are in tune with what the Lord has promised you and what the Lord wants to give you, you pray for those things, and the Lord is going to answer you. So it's one of those things in your relationship with the Lord, you're going to know that it's not necessary to ask for a Cadillac. You're going to know that there's more important things to answer for. So it just another thing that I saw there, this intercessory prayer again through Genesis. And so he prays and she conceived, but the children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is so, then why this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. When her days were to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now, the first came forth, red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterwards, his brother came forth, and his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth. So she, again here, you see prayer. The prayer is answered, and she, think about this also. Part of this is we know the story already. We've probably been through it. Most of you are probably familiar with this story. So we know what's going to happen, but she's got something going on inside of her, and they don't have the thing with the, what's the thing with the jelly where they look? Yeah, they don't have the ultrasound now, so you can see the babies. So maybe she's thinking something. I always forget what that's called. So she can't, they can't see the baby. She doesn't know what's going on. So she's probably worried. She said, why am I this way? I got pregnant and something's happening inside us. She doesn't say at this point that she knows she has twins or anything, but she wouldn't know that because we don't have modern technology. So when she goes to inquire of the Lord, I think it's probably pretty urgent. If you put her in her spot and she's got this going on, why am I this way? I'm finally pregnant. Now what's going on? I don't know what's going on. And the cool thing is not only does she inquire of the Lord, but the Lord answers her. And again, trying to think about this in a vacuum, the Lord's answer to her, I would think, would be very cool and maybe a little bit scary. So the Lord says, hey, there's two nations in your womb. Okay, that's big news. So she would probably discern from that, oh, they're twins. That's why there's so much moving around in there. And it tells her, okay, there's going to be two nations, and one will be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. And it's interesting that she says this because in this time, you know, again, thinking about the rest of the story, we see some of that play out with her actions and Isaac's actions, but she doesn't know at this time what she's going to do later, right? And so this has to be an interesting answer to prayer for her. But at least God is telling her, again, it's really cool that she talks to God, God answers, and now God is telling her what's going to happen. So I would think that, okay, now she's got this information. How cool is that? Because at first, what I thought was, you know, a lot of times the Lord says, don't be afraid, or I am with you or something. And the Lord just gives an answer. Here's the information. And at first I thought, well, he didn't comfort her anything. But if you think about us, a lot of times we're information junkies. Even if something isn't going that great, I thought this is really actually, once I thought about it for a while, this is actually a really good answer for the Lord. Because sometimes we just like information, right? I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening. What's going on inside me, Lord? And all of a sudden he just tells her. And so that's got to be very liberating, right? Oh, now I have the information. I can be at ease. And that's the comfort that God brings, even though he doesn't say, be at peace, like some of the other times when he shows up. So I thought that was just really cool. And when she has the babies, now the first one came out red. He was hairy all over like a garment. You think, wow, that's weird. Is it like that? But I think we all knew that person in junior high that was like hairy already in seventh grade, you know, that just came with, anyway. So, and then here comes Jacob holding his heel, and he was called Jacob. So, and then Isaac is 60 years old. So now we have the birth of Jacob and Esau, Jacob the heel catcher, and the story, it's not, God is true when he says that, because if you look forward in the story, as I read again, these guys are at it their entire life. And it's going to just switch to that. Now they're born, and in verse 26 and verse 27, all of a sudden, they're older. Now when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man, living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff, for I'm famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, but I'm about to die. So what use is the birthright to me?" So Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. And he ate, and he drank, and he rose and went on his way. And Esau despised his birthright. So it's just kind of interesting that the just interesting dichotomy that Esau is a skillful hunter, but he came into the field and he's hungry. He has nothing to eat. I don't know. Interesting. And he was famished. And so Jacob, obviously, for whatever reason, maybe this is just his nature, but maybe he's been looking for an opportunity. Maybe his mom told him one will serve the other. We don't know. It doesn't tell us. But he comes in from the field, and older brother says, "Give me some food." And he says, you know, Jacob says, "First sell me your birthright." It seems to me like that escalated awfully quickly, right? I mean, you go from, "Hey, I'm hungry. Okay, sell me your birthright. That's all your inheritance." Because in that day and age, you know, your birthright, the firstborn son would get the inheritance. You saw that with Isaac, the son of the promise, right? And the secondborn might get gifts, but, you know, he would have to serve. So it seems that he's not thinking clearly. In our day and age, and I guess this is a real thing, because my wife and my daughters have this, they get hangry. Right? Because I've got a few extra pounds. So when I get hungry, I'm like, okay, I'm hungry. I can wait. You know, if it's a half an hour, a few hours, I'm not going to starve to death. When they get hungry, they get mad. Like, here's some crackers before we eat something so I don't get in trouble. So he's in that mode and he's not thinking very clearly. So give me some stew. Okay, sell me your birthright, your whole inheritance. And he says, Esau says, "Well, what does that mean to me if I die? Come on, man, are you really going to die? You're talking, you're walking, you haven't fell on the floor in starvation, really?" He's not, So, and then he makes him swear, and Jacob gave him bread and lentil stew. Now, I don't know about you, I don't know about lentil stew, it must have meat in it. I've had lentil soup. It's all right. I mean, only all right. He sold his birthright for some bread and some lentil stew. So obviously, it seems to me like Esau, and again, this isn't in the text, but it seems like Esau is impulsive. He thinks in the now. This is a very long-term solution for a short-term problem. it just seems nuts to me that in a rage of being hungry that he's willing to do that, or not thinking about it, not thinking about the consequences. He just impulsively says, yeah, I make this decision because I'm hungry. And it's not just that. I think anything where we make impulsive decisions in our flesh without taking a minute to pray it through or think it through can get you in trouble, whether it's food or lust or anything like that. So maybe Esau's just one of those guys that kind of lives in the flesh. So then on to chapter 26. So then it just kind of stops that story and starts with the rest of the narrative. Now, there was a famine in the land, besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, and the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt, stay in the land in which I shall tell you. Sojourn in the land, and I will be with you and bless you. For you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish an oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth may be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge and my commandments and my statutes and my laws." So, you see God putting, I feel like God is putting Isaac through a kind of a test here, kind of a process, because, and it's clear, he says, this is a very different famine than your father had, so this is not your father's trial, this is your trial, and he says, don't go down to Egypt. And the interesting thing about that, maybe there's supply in Egypt, maybe there's plenty, and that was the easy thing to do, but God tells him, stay in the land, which I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to give this land to your descendants. And the other thing about this is, you see, it's going to take him a while to find his place in this land as we go through this chapter. So this is Isaac's journey of faith. The promise is the same, but it's a different famine than his father had, and it shows that each of us, each generation, has to work out their faith on their own. God's promise is not going to change to us. God's promise is not going to change to this family. Each generation has to commit to that promise and commit to their love and following the Lord. And so God is starting that here. And he says, I will give it to your descendants because your father Abraham obeyed me and kept my commandments. So then he says in verse 6, so Isaac lived in Gerar, and the men of the place asked about his wife, and he said, she is my sister, for he was afraid to say my wife, thinking that the men of the place might kill him on the account of Rebekah, because she was beautiful. So like father, like son, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, however it works. And again, I've not been in this situation, and it's one of those things in faith. I think as parents, we tend to share our successes in faith and life, and we don't tend to share the bad things. So we have no idea whether Abraham said, hey, if you're traveling with your wife, I did something twice that maybe you should know about that you should avoid. So we don't know if Abraham said that, or maybe Abraham was like, I'm not going to mention that to the boy because that was a little bit embarrassing. Whether Abraham said that or not. But here's the thing I can't wrap my mind around again. And again, I haven't been in a place where I could be killed on the account of my wife. A couple times I thought I might be killed by my wife, but that's that's because something came out of my mouth or something. But I don't want to be killed because of my wife, and so he says he's my sister. So I don't know if that offers him more protection or something like that, but it seems counter to what dudes do, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem just counter to, hey, my wife's beautiful. Hey, stop looking at my wife, man. You know, wouldn't he want to fight somebody or stand up for his wife instead of say, yeah, she's my sister? I don't get it, but it's a thing that they had to do. Maybe that was common practice in the land that's a thing that they did. I don't know. I don't understand it. But Obviously, they'd been there a while, because what it says next is, it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, certainly she is your wife. Why then did you say she is your sister? And Isaac said, because I might die on the account of her. And Abimelech said, what is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with her, and you might have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, he who touches this man's wife shall surely be put to death. So, obviously, sooner or later, your sin will find you out. Sooner or later, your lie will find you out. And Abimelech, now just one side note, Abimelech, that could be a term like president or something. So like Abimelech, who is the king, this may not be the same Abimelech that Abraham dealt with. It may be the same title, but a different man, because this is years down the line. So chances are that's the case, and probably because of some of the things that happen on down the line in this chapter. So this is probably a different man than Abraham dealt with. But Abimelech looked out the window and said, huh, that must be his wife, because that seems a little bit too close for him to be his sister. And so he calls him in and asks him, how does a dude feel at that moment when you're standing in front of the king and says, hey, how's your sister? Look like you guys are having a good time down there. Yeah, that's got to be awkward. But he says, okay, I thought I'd be killed because somebody bumped me off and take my wife. And Abimelech says, well, somebody could have lain with her. And I don't know if there's just loose morals, or I don't know if somebody could have just grabbed her and said, hey, but at any rate, whatever their culture is, Abimelech is realizing, okay, there, because of this lie, somebody else could have committed adultery not knowing, and then you're bringing sin on my people. Why did you do that? So he puts out to everybody, hey, don't touch this man's wife or you'll be put to death. And I would think there'd have to be some, I don't know, I was just thinking about this later after he says, don't touch this. People probably already knew, since they'd been for a while, that they'd said they were brother and sister. So he probably has some shame to bear with people around town. Oh, that really isn't your sister. Oh, gotcha. That's what you get for telling a lie. Verse 12. Now Isaac showed in the land that he sowed in the land that he reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. And then the man became very rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy, for he had possessions of flocks and herds and great household, and so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are too powerful for us. So Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. So it's interesting that even after that, just like Abraham, Isaac is blessed. And it doesn't tell us about his repentance. I think it must be there, that sort of thing. But it says very clearly that when he sowed, he reaped 100-fold, and this is the Lord's blessing. The Lord is blessing Isaac, and he has a specific purpose for this, and his household grows, and he has servants. And so the Philistines are saying, hey, look at how good this guy is doing, and they had envy. And so their envy causes them to say, well, we're gonna fill your well with water. And again, this is one of those things where in our day and age, when we can, even in this country, you can go to the tap and you can open up the tap and water comes right out into your glass. Or if nobody's around, you can just take the sprayer and get a drink. And you could get a bottle of water. I mean, even in some countries in the world, they don't have that. So when you think about this, where in this first world country that we have, we have water coming pretty easily, but when you are filling somebody's well in this situation, this is a pretty serious thing because they don't have that. The well is their source of water. This is where they're getting their water to drink, to cook, to give their livestock water. So if you cut the water off, people die. I think you can only live without water like 3 days or something. I don't, 3 days. And so this is a pretty heavy, this is a nasty jab by the Philistines to Isaac and his family because they're envious. So this is they just filled their well. I'll just go over to this other well. This is a pretty heavy duty deal that they're doing to him there. So the Philistines are filling up their wells and then they say, go away from us for you're too powerful for us. And so what does Isaac do? He departed and went to Gerar. And so then Isaac dug again the wells of water which he had been dug in the days of his father Abraham. For the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave these same names which his father had given to him. But Isaac's servants dug in the valley and they found there a well of flowing water. And the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with herdsmen of Isaac, saying, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek, because it because he contended with them. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too. So he named it Sithna. And he moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he named it Raboth. And he said, "At last, the Lord has made room for us, and we will be fruitful in the land." So you see Isaac, remember he's a sojourner, and this is forcing them out because the wells keep getting filled. And finally, he has a well that they did not contend with. So this must be the sign from the Lord, as Isaac sees it, that this is the place where we can stay. This is the place where we can be fruitful in the land, because there must be room for us, because everywhere else the people filled the wells with land and forced us to go on. So that's pretty cool that, you know, maybe it's not the best, easiest way that my water gets shut off, so we have to pick up and move, but the Lord has provided a place, and he's moved them along in the way that he decided to allow to get them where he wanted to go. And so then in 23 it says, "Then he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, 'I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham.' So he built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there, and Isaac's servants dug a well." And that's just really cool. So he went up to Beersheba, a place where his dad was at. And again, isn't it cool that the Lord appears to him? And he reminds him, "I'm the God of your father. And don't be afraid, because I'm with you." And he renews the promise that he gave to his father. "Because I made this covenant with your father, I'm going to multiply your descendants." And so, again, what you see Isaac do here is that he builds an altar and he called upon the name of the Lord. And it's another thing that we see that Abraham, in his death, at the beginning of chapter 25, he provides for his sons and he gives the inheritance. But the thing that I really think is neat that Abraham passed along to his son is that he has this encounter with God, and then Isaac built an altar there and he called on the name of the Lord. It seems to me that Isaac has his own relationship with God, but one of the things that Abraham passed down to him was faith. That when the Lord does something to you, that when the Lord talks to you, there's a thing that you should do. You should worship the Lord because this thing has happened to you. And it's the renewing of the covenant, but how cool is it that God came down and spoke? Good place to build an altar if God spoke to you. Then verse 26, "Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzah and Phicol and the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, 'Why have you come to me, since you hate me and you have sent me away from you?' And they said, 'We see plainly that the Lord has been with you.' So let there be an oath between us, between you and us, and we'll make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you, and have done to you nothing but good, and have sent you away in peace. Now, sent you away in peace, you are now blessed of the Lord. Then they made a feast, and they ate, and they drank, and in the morning they arose, and they exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And now it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said, "We have found water." So he called it Sipnah. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. So after he builds the altar, Abimelech comes to him. And so if you remember back a couple of chapters, Abimelech and Abraham made a very similar covenant because they were afraid of Abraham and how wealthy he had become, so that they wouldn't contend with each other. And so that was supposed to be for their generation and the coming generations. So it doesn't say anything about that covenant, but these two guys, Isaac and Abimelech, make a new covenant in that. So it doesn't say it's carrying on the other one. That's one of the reasons why people say that Abimelech is a title, not necessarily the guy, because the guy would have remembered that. But the interesting thing is, Isaac asked him, you know, "Why have you come to me since you hate me and you've sent me away?" And he said, "We plainly see that the Lord has been with you," and they want to make an oath. Let us make a covenant. So it's interesting to me that Abimelech, the Philistines here, they see clearly, they're able to clearly articulate also that the Lord is with Isaac, just like they were able to clearly articulate that the Lord was with Abraham. And they want to make a covenant with Isaac to make sure that he won't turn on them. It's interesting to me, the question that came to me is, if they can see that the Lord is blessing Isaac, if they can see that the Lord is living and active, why don't they go to the Lord? Why don't they just serve the Lord? Why wouldn't they, after they see this working in this man's life, say, "Hey, Isaac, we want to have peace with you, but we want to know your God," instead of going to Isaac and just saying, "Hey, let's have peace with you"? Wouldn't you want to go just one step higher above his head and have peace with God? I don't understand why they don't do that. Because they can see, but they don't confess. And it's almost kind of heartbreaking, because I think probably that happens sometimes in our world. As a matter of fact, it just hit my head that we were on a mission trip in Trinidad. Me and a couple of gals that were from the youth group shared the gospel with a Hindu man. And he said, "Yeah, I believe that." He said, "I want your Jesus." But he said, "I can't, because my family will put me out. I'll have nowhere to go." And he walked away. So by his words, he said, "I know who God is," but he didn't accept him as Lord. And that's just, it's kind of heartbreaking on that. So, I mean, obviously the text here doesn't tell us anything about that. It doesn't tell us whether Isaac, you know, shared with him the things of the Lord. It's just interesting to me when you can see the Lord that clearly. Gosh, you just hope for these guys or somebody like that, if they see the Lord that clearly, why wouldn't they seek him? Why wouldn't they want him to be Lord of their life? I don't know, I can't answer the question, but at least they want to make peace. So instead of going to God, they go to Isaac, because they can realize that if the Lord is blessing him, that he has the power to make a covenant. And so that's what they do. "Hey, don't do us any harm." And then they say again in 29, that we want to have, that we sent you away in peace, and we see that you're blessed of the Lord. And the connotation there is, to me, is that you're blessed of the Lord, so if you decide to turn on us, that blessing means that you're going to wipe us out. Well, get on the right side, guys. I just don't get it. So they made a feast, they ate and drank, and in the morning they rose, they exchanged oath, and they sent them away, and they departed in peace. So now they have peace again with the Philistines. They've made this deal, so they can live in the spot where God has made space for them. Now the Philistines feel like they're taken care of. And just another cool thing happens. His servants came in and said, hey, we dug another well and we found water. So, hey, you're in the right place. You have a place where I've provided water again. He calls it Beersheba. Just really cool that God is continuing to bless Isaac. And then verse 34, these last two verses just switch gears and go right to Esau. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So it's interesting that he was 40 years old, and all of a sudden he gets married to two gals. I don't know what that ceremony looks like. Guessing they didn't have like a premarital process for that, for that particular thing. So it shows you a couple things about Esau. It seems to me like he would have been there. He would have heard his parents' story that Isaac and Rebekah, the way they came together. Abraham said, don't marry one of these Canaanites. Go back to my people and get away. He says to his the servant of his house, go back to my people and get a wife from my kinsmen for my son Isaac. And there was a specific reason for that. We talked about that last time, that people of different faiths tend to take you away from faith, or there's always friction there. And you see it over and over going forward in the Bible, where the children of Israel marry into the other cultures and it just turns bad every time they do. And so Esau doesn't learn from his parents at all. And he just goes and takes two Hittite women. So you would think also that maybe Esau's a guy who does not have regard for the promises of God. And maybe he doesn't have also regard for maybe the consequences of not following God. I'm just going to do what I want to do. And he takes these two women. And you know, like we talked earlier, Esau's a guy who's living in the flesh. And maybe he's like, Samson says to his parents, hey, get me that girl for my wife. She looks good to me. Maybe that's his thinking. I don't know. But ultimately, it says, because he married Hittite women, they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. And this is one of those things that even when we do premarital counseling on the initial questionnaire is, you know, things about your relationship, but it's also how do you get along with your prospective in-laws? Do you guys have good communication? And we talk about that because it's important, because when you marry somebody, you marry into their family and you're going to have to get along for a lifetime. And so it doesn't say why they brought them grief. Maybe they had other worship practices. Maybe they had a different kind of familial craziness than their family. But as you're thinking about that in families, and as we talk to the young people in our midst, that it's so important that we have the same values as those who we marry. People, I've not seen it work out well. This sometimes in our culture they call it missionary dating. Well, I'm going to date somebody and bring them to Lord through dating. Not really a successful thing. I don't think Esau was even into that. He was just into whatever he wanted. But it causes them grief. And we don't want to cause our parents grief. And I would think even in that, it doesn't say this in the text, but I would think even wouldn't it have to bring grief to Esau himself, if you're wives and your parents are at odds, that's going to get on you too. He's opened up a door of nonsense for him. So that's kind of where this leaves off. So lots that we can learn there. Prayer, intercessory prayer that Rebecca does, putting up an altar when God has spoken to Isaac. We can learn that we should, from Esau, hey, we should be thinking about who we marry and what we're teaching our kids about marriage and the importance of not only sharing the gospel, but like these guys who can see God working, but even though we're sharing the gospel, sharing the gospel in a marriage relationship isn't great. Somebody should already be there. Next week, Pastor Tom is going to pick up in verse 27. And the story continues with Jacob and Esau, continues to go forward. It goes a little bit faster, but it's cool stuff. Let me pray. Father God, I thank you for this journey that you've given us through your word, how everything, even if it seems mundane, has great life lessons for us, has great things that we can enjoy. Lord, I just ask that if there are people among us that that are like the Philistines who see you working, Lord, that you would give us words and a life that would be open and welcoming to them, that we could share. Lord, that we would be people who would be praying for each other. We would be people who are praising you in our lives and just rejoicing in the things that you've done so the people around can see. Lord, we thank you for all these things, and may we all be blessed on our way. In Jesus' name, amen.